It's time for another episode of Just a Bit Outside with your hosts, Stark and Massaro.
Way back, Blue Jays win it! Touch of all, Joe! Brett Favre! Touchdown, Green Bay! Bless you, boys! What a game!
We are live. What a sports weekend. It has to be up there in the top five sports weekends of the year. So we got a lot of great sports that we will touch on today, including a breakdown of the Super Bowl. Scheffler wins the waste management. The Olympics will showcase Canada versus USA. NHL coaches are dropping like flies, and the NBA trade deadline has some interesting moves. But Mike, happy Valentine's Day for you, and how was your week?
Yes, right back at you. Wonderful, wonderful day. Pretty uneventful on this end. February always kind of is a bit more of a boring part of the year, I think. I did visit some family, so that was good. But Super Bowl, like we said last week, just when you have no team in the game, you just want to see a good game, good halftime show, good festivities. Yeah. And I think everything delivered on that front.
I saw you posted a beautiful steak. You want to walk us through that process? Must take you all weekend to get it settled and ready for the Super Bowl.
Yeah, no, I don't. this is the second straight week you've asked me to share a recipe.
Not sharing recipes.
No,
what the hell?
No, that's you don't go ask the chef how they make things. You just enjoy them. That's insulting.
Wait for the cookbook to come out.
Oh yeah, but no, it's a recipe. Actually, this recipe we found it in a Toronto Sun newspaper back in the 90s, and clipped it out, kept it, remember it. And, you know, a couple times a year we do the flank steak. It never disappoints. So marinated that beautiful piece on, I think it was Wednesday afternoon. So,
wow, that
you know,
soon, eh?
Yeah, 3-4 solid days of marination time in the fridge, and pulled it out a couple hours before it went on the BBQ. And, you know, didn't stand much of a chance surviving the plate.
Good for you, man. Good for you. Yeah, we had a full-blown weekend. I had my son's fifth birthday party, so we were at a little indoor play place. It's crazy. You know, you got sweaty kids running around, snot running everywhere, kids jumping on each other, kids getting hurt, kids crying. You know, you get them all the food, the pizza, the cake. They barely eat it. You spend all this time and money organizing to get it. These kids don't even give a crap. They just want to run around with their friends. But at least they're having some normal birthday parties, so that is good. But, you know, we were going around getting things, balloons and different decorations to make sure we had everything. And it's wild because, you know, Saturday morning, people are getting football balloons and, you know, different food platters ready for their big Super Bowl party. So Super Bowl parties are back. It's a thing. I didn't really do one this year, just kind of hung out with some family. But I remember the good old days. We used to always get together and have a good large amount of people together, betting on different things, doing the squares. Love doing squares for a big Super Bowl game. But hopefully that's getting back, and I'm looking forward to having some big parties. For us, we did chili. My wife makes great chili, so we had chili. We had about 20 different flavors of chips, so it was great. The only thing holding it back was I was busy watching the three-hole playoff in the golf while the kickoff was going on. So luckily I had the two TVs going, and I was able to stand up and watch and track everything that was going on. Didn't miss a thing. So that was great. But halftime show, Mike, what did you think of the halftime show?
You know, I thought it was good. You had Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, Eminem, Mary J. Blige, you know, some of the biggest names in hip hop. And I thought it was really good, entertaining, and good luck to whoever is on deck for next year.
Yeah, I thought it was awesome. I thought it might have been one of the best ones, ranking up there with the Prince halftime show. I mean, we're used to
rain.
Them. Yeah, were you in rain in Minnesota, I believe, which is even crazier. Yeah. They seem to keep bringing these old bands together or bringing them back for the halftime shows, and it's just kind of run its course. They need a kind of younger audience, as crazy as that is to say. You know, these are our kind of iconic older bands, you know, the Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, Eminem, you know, those are from when our age group, anyone in their, you know, 30s, even early 40s, you know, they remember them from their teens and early 20 days where it was really big. So they're trying to capture that audience now, you know, no more of the groups in their 70s coming back out and barely being able to stand up on stage. So I thought that was great. Every single song that they played was a hit. The stage looked really clean and cool. It was kind of like a house party type of vibe where they were bouncing around from room to room. They had the cars out there that they were dancing on as well, the lowriders, which was pretty cool. The dancers that were out in the field looked like professionals, where some of these Super Bowls, it's just like random fans just running out on the field, jumping up and down. So I like that aspect of keeping it like real professional, and everyone was playing a part and dressed up for it. The only downfall I actually thought about was that it was about 8 p.m. Eastern, right? When this halftime show was going on, 8:30, whatever it was. But that means it was 5:30 West Coast time, and it was still sunny while they were performing. And if you think about halftime shows, usually it's dark. There's all the lights are off too. You have different light shows going on and different visual things that you can see more so than just the person performing. They couldn't have any of that because it was the middle of the day. So it was like going to a rap concert in the afternoon, which was a little bit different. And the other thing I thought that they missed out, you mentioned Dr. Dre, Snoop, Eminem, Mary J, Kendrick Lamar, 50 Cent, lots of comments about him and how he was looking. But really what I thought they were going to do, and I had seen on Twitter that they might do, and I thought it was a big miss considering they were in California, they needed the Tupac hologram. How could they not have Tupac with that group in California doing California Love? Would have been the perfect thing. The roof would have blown off.
Yeah, good point. That's something that certainly would have added to it. But I mean, you know, they had so many performers and you only have so much time to get through all of that. I thought it went by fairly quickly. Like Sometimes halftime shows are like, all right, let's get a move on here. Let's get the game on. But, you know, I kind of looked up and I was like, oh, wow. Like, I thought it felt like 5 minutes. It moved along really quick, really, really great visually, but, you know, enjoyable.
Yeah, I've heard some former NFL players this week, you know, every single one was interviewed in some aspect. And they were talking about how, you know, our usual halftime is, you know, 15 minutes maybe. By the time you run in, go to the washroom, grab a Gatorade, have a quick meeting with your positions coach, you're right back on the field kind of getting warmed up to start the second half. But this is obviously so much longer that they kind of have to go back to the room and refocus and stay loose, stay stretching and making sure that they're not getting cold or hurting any muscles when they come back out for the second half. So it's interesting from a player's perspective to think what's going on while the halftime show is going on.
Or you could just do what McPherson did and go watch the halftime show.
What an idiot. What a dummy. Like, why? To think, well, imagine
that was great.
Imagine the game came down to him having to kick a game-winning field goal and he missed, and then it was like showing him smiling like a little dummy on the field watching the halftime show. I heard a quote. He was like, it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I wasn't going to miss seeing these guys. The Super Bowl is the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Get back and get focused, or stretching out your legs to make sure you're kicking the perfect field goal. He's lucky that it didn't come down to him, because that would have been a bad look if he missed.
Or he hits it and he just talks about how the halftime show propelled him to greatness.
Yeah, he's singing Eminem in his head while he's kicking maybe a little gin and juice. Well, hey, stick around. We got our T5 coming up right after this break with lots of great sports from the past week. One of the great things about the Super Bowl is talking about it for the next week with each person you see. Kind of like how you always have to say Happy New Year's till about January 20th, because each time you see somebody, it has to be said. So the Super Bowl, of course, will be our T1. The underdog Cincinnati Bengals did not quit when they were down early or at the halftime, and Joe Burrow led the team to a 20-16 lead late in the fourth quarter with hopes that their defense would win the game. However, Matt Stafford marched down the field for 79-yard drive to win the game with a Cooper Kupp TD for the Rams' first Super Bowl win since moving back to LA. Of course, there was way more to break down in the game. So, Mike, what were some of the highlights for you?
Well, I think, you know, we touched on it last week. The big question was the Bengals' offensive line going to be able to hold back the Rams' pass rush? And the answer was no. I mean, Joe Burrow got sacked 7 times. Congrats to you for hitting your prop bet. But, you know, 7 sacks, the amount of pressures he faced throughout the game, they could just never really get going consistently. Now, they made plays. There's no doubt about it. They made plays, and Joe Mixon was running the ball pretty well when he had an opportunity to run it. But at the end of the day, the pass rush just was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak, and it was evident on the last drive of the game.
Yeah, it's funny because when you think of Sean McVay, you think of this offensive genius. They always talk about how he's so good offensively, coming up with the plays and working with different quarterbacks, and that's kind of been his MO. And oddly enough, it was the Rams' defense that was really the star of the game. They were the ones that were pressuring Burrow nonstop, as you mentioned, and the pass rush just dominated the game. 7 sacks. I mean, as you mentioned, my prop bet was 5.5. They covered it on their own. And we talked about how the game in the playoffs a little bit earlier against Tennessee, he was sacked 9 times, but they were still able to win. And, you know, could he really do that again, getting sacked, you know, 4 times even, 5 times and still winning? 7 was just way too much. I mean, they just forced him to throw it away at bad times when even he was getting close to being sacked, like the final play of the game. That could have easily been another sack, but it was 4th down. He tried to just chuck it down there and hope for a catch of some sort, and it just didn't happen. Donald, too good on that defensive line. I mean, the only bad defensive play was the Higgins 75-yard TD to start the 3rd quarter that actually should have been a face mask penalty on Higgins that really the play shouldn't have counted. And other than that, the Rams' defense was solid.
Yeah, thankfully it didn't, because it allowed me to eventually hit my prop bet as well, with T. Higgins having the most receiving yards. But yeah, I mean, crazy, you know, kind of a methodical first half. I mean, OBJ gets the score, puts the Rams up 7-0. Bengals kick the field goal. You know, Kupp goes down, gets the touchdown. They miss the extra point on a handling issue. And then Higgins gets one right before half there to make it 13-10. Bengals come out first play, 75 yards, as you mentioned. Next play for the Rams, Stafford's picked off, gets them a field goal. And at that point, the Bengals are up, what, 20-13 after the field goal, after the interception. So after that, you know, they just kind of stalled offensively, and the Rams kind of held themselves in the game. They weren't doing a whole lot. The run game was non-existent. I think obviously once OBJ went down in the second quarter there, that really affected the Rams offensively. It gave them no second option really from a receiving perspective.
Yeah, and OBJ had a great start. 2 catches. He got the first TD. He had 52 yards, but it looked like a bad knee injury. Rumors are, I think it's a ACL, which is on the same knee. He's actually hurt before. Yeah. You know, I feel bad for him, but, you know, he looked to really fit in with this Rams team and was just a nice piece. And he was okay with just being a nice piece instead of being the guy. He understood that, you know, Cooper Kupp, he's the guy that they're going to go to as the number one option, and he's going to get lots of secondary plays when they double team him, and it worked out perfect for him. But the game really changed after that injury. You know, the lack of kind of options kind of caused a little bit of concern for Stafford. A couple 4 and outs happened right after that. They just couldn't get the mojo going, and the game really shifted. But this is a theme I think we talked about all season long with NFL quarterbacks, and Stafford fits that mold. He plays the game perfectly. Not too much risk. I mean, even the interception was really a bouncing ball. It was kind of out of his hands. It wasn't a bad throw, really, or a miscommunication. He just happened to have a bad play there. But he used these weapons so well. He always finds the open man. He had 283 passing yards, which oddly enough was 1 off of the total that was on the betting books. But 3 TDs, that wiped it all away. 1 interception, so what? The run game, as you mentioned, nowhere to be found, which was a big shock for me. Akers only 21 yards. No one else really got it going. That really forced Stafford's hand to be throwing the ball a lot more, 40 times. But he played a great game. I mean, not an MVP type of game, obviously, but good enough to be the leader to get the win. And that's what this team really needed, and that's why they made the trade for him. They needed someone that was going to come in, calm everyone down, make the right plays, make the smart plays. Don't put yourself in any bad situations. Don't have any sacks where you're losing 10, 15, 20 yards even, like some of these younger quarterbacks are making these mistakes. So all in all, hats off to Stafford. I thought he played a great game.
Yeah, a couple, you know, two turnovers from him really didn't provide costly at the end of the day. But 6 minutes left in the fourth quarter, you know, Bengals were facing 3rd and 9, and Burrow hits Tyler Boyd, who's usually automatic. He drops the ball, which forces the Bengals to have to punt. And then, you know, Cooper Kupp comes alive. The Rams go 15 plays, 79 yards to get the touchdown. Questionable ending there with the call on Wilson. A lot of people very vocal that that wasn't a call, but I felt like the officials did a good job. And then the last few minutes, it kind of just lost off track a bit, went haywire. But you know, I was kind of hoping as a neutral, like I said, you know, when the Bengals got the ball back after the Rams scored, it's 23-20, maybe they can get into field goal range to you know, to try and tie it up and force overtime. But the pass rush just prevented that from happening.
Yeah, and having said all that, with the pass rush and being sacked 7 times, I still think Joe Burrow, he's a star, man. He is a star. And he's going to be one of those quarterbacks that's calm, cool, collective as he continues to play in the league. Let's remember, he's only really had a year and a half. He had a really bad injury, missed a bunch of time last year. He did the best that he could with what he had, 263 yards, a TD pass. But when you're on your back 7 times in a game, it's just not feasible that you can win. Now, I don't want to say this, you know, we'll see him back here. He'll be back again, because we both know it's really hard to win a Super Bowl, and it's just as hard to even make it to one. And not every quarterback gets that chance to play in this big game multiple times. Ask Dan Marino. Everyone thought he would be back after getting to one at a young age and never did. It takes a lot more than just being a good quarterback or a great quarterback to make it to the Super Bowl. You need the perfect situation. You need healthy teammates. You need to stay healthy. You need the team to build around you and have the right players in the right spots. Because let's be honest, if I was betting on the Bengals to make the Super Bowl next year, I don't think I would take that bet, because I'm worried that they're not going to fix their offensive line and it's just going to be the same issues. So what are the Bengals going to be able to do to get back and get Burrow in this situation? I don't know, but they better make some changes. Otherwise, they could easily slip back to being a team that just makes the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, the O-line needs to be priority one for them in the offseason. They got a great running back. They got a great group of receivers, franchise quarterback. Offense is in a good spot. Defense, you know, they can play. They can play. They're no pushovers. They're not world beaters, but they need to address the O-line if they're going to, you know, get back in the conversation in the AFC next year, because division's going to get tougher. You know, Pittsburgh is going to look a little different. The Ravens probably aren't going to do what they did this year. And the Browns, I mean, battled some injuries and hopefully they can bounce back. So they're in a tough division, but they need the O-line help. The only other things from the Super Bowl I want to touch on, just lots of good storylines aside from the ones we touched on, but a lot of growing chatter that Aaron Donald could be considering retirement. Sean McVay, curious story came out a couple days before the Super Bowl talking about him potentially moving on and into the broadcast world. So while the season ends as of the Super Bowl, there's going to be a lot kind of keeping us going here through the spring and into the summer and until we play again come September.
Yeah, my overall thoughts of the game, I mean, it was a close game. It was entertaining, let's call it that. But there was no memorable moments or plays like we've seen in past Super Bowls, something that's going to really stick out and say, oh, I remember that Super Bowl between the Bengals and the Rams. So there wasn't too much flash or dash that is going to be a memorable Super Bowl. But that's just because defense wins championships. And we have to remember that, Mike. Next year when we're picking, you know, we're doing our preview show and we're picking who's going to win the Super Bowl, let's remember that defense wins championships. And when there's a good defensive team, put a little asterisk beside them because there's a good chance they're going to be in that dance at the end of the year. Now, the Super Bowl might be the biggest party of the year, but oddly enough, the second best party happens on the same weekend as the big game. That party is at the 16th hole at TPC Scottsdale at the WM Phoenix Open, and that will be our T2. Golf can be stuffy and intimidating at times, but once a year, the players and fans can let loose while still competing for millions of dollars at the WM Phoenix Open. More and more top players are playing in this event, and it showed this weekend with a jam-packed leaderboard. But it came down to two of America's up-and-coming stars as Patrick Cantlay and Scottie Scheffler dueled it out for three playoff holes before Scheffler nailed a 26-foot birdie putt for the win. Mike, tell me this course is now on your bucket list.
Certainly seems like a party destination. I want to check out. You know, it's kind of good. I know there's a lot of debate about kind of the pictures and the videos we've seen from the 16th and the beer bottles and everything on the course and everything like that. I mean, if it's just a one-off thing and this is kind of what to expect at this tournament, then so be it. It's what you get once a year.
Yeah, and I mean, it really didn't affect the guys when that were in the leaderboard and they were going for it. They understood what was at stake here and they were playing their hearts out and they were focused on winning it. You got Scottie Scheffler, 25-year-old from New Jersey. He was the 2013 U.S. Junior winner. He went to the University of Texas. He was the Corn Ferry Player of the Year. He was 2-0-1 at the Ryder Cup last year. But this was his big moment, his first win on the tour. He's finally broken out. All the talk about when's he going to win? This kid's going to win soon. He's that good of a player. He strikes the ball so good. And now he's putting lights out, which was the big thing that was missing earlier on last year even. And now he's playing great. He was in the middle of the pack after two rounds. But on Saturday, he starts out on the back nine, which maybe was a little bit calming for him, staying away from everything that was going on. He went through, you know, 16, 17, 18 early on before people were a little loose of those holes, and he went lights out. He shot 62 on Saturday, and the fans just kind of didn't even know that he was around because when he was really playing good, he was back on the front nine and there wasn't as much attention. But Sunday, you know, we got into the final group. He was even par through 12 holes, only even par through 12 holes. And then he went nuts. He looked at it, had all the right stuff. He birdied 13, 14, 15, 17. And then he had the chance for birdie on 18 to win it outright. Just missed, but that's okay. Went to the playoff. What did you think about Scheffler? I thought he was just so focused and ready to play, and he had it in his eyes the whole way.
You know, I think you understated it a bit. He almost missed the cut on Friday. That's how close, you know, or how impressive his kind of run over the course of Saturday and Sunday was. This guy almost missed the cut. Shoots 62 on Saturday, as you said, and then just turns it up on the back nine. Birdies four of the last six, as you mentioned, and had a five-footer to win on 18, just misses that. But, you know, a guy that has consistently been knocking on the door. You mentioned successful Ryder Cup, beat John Rahm, I think it was head-to-head in a singles match last year. So it was going to be just a matter of time before we see his name at the top. And, you know, look, he's done really well. I think it's six consecutive top 20s at major tournaments. So he's one of those names that's always in the conversation. And he finally gets his first tour win.
Yeah, and it's funny. I mean, I had the golf on the big screen and the Super Bowl preview stuff going on one of the side TVs, and he misses that putt on 18. We're going to a playoff. I'm like, what do we do here? The football game's just about to start. So we put the football game on the big screen. The golf's on a side TV, but I'm watching closely. First playoff hole between Scheffler and Cantlay. They both hit it right in the middle of the fairway, up on the green, two putt pars. Okay, move on, back to the 18th tee. Second one, now they both go into the rough on the right, and Cantlay's ball was just buried. I was worried he was going to have to just kind of punch it out to the fairway. He comes up a little bit short. Scheffler, he's kind of standing in the bunker, but he's hitting it at waist high. He rockets it past the green. I'm like, oh, this is great for Cantlay. I think he's got a chance to win it. Both guys get up and down. Amazing short games to force the third playoff hole. And then the third playoff hole, Cantlay's right in the middle of the fairway, puts it onto the green. He's about 10 feet away. Scheffler's actually in the rough, and he puts it on just onto the green. And I was like, another great opportunity for Cantlay here. But Scheffler just nails it right uphill, 26 feet, as I mentioned, for the birdie. Put all the pressure on Cantlay with a 10-footer that he thought it was going to be a chance for him to win with a birdie putt. But no, and he can't hit it. I mean, these two guys are great players, great up-and-coming players. I mean, Cantlay, he's one of those guys that he's really quiet. He lets his game do the talking. He's had a little bit more success on tour than Scheffler, but he's still looking for that breakout run everyone's thinking about coming. He had that tournament in his hands coming down the stretch. He just couldn't get it going the last few holes. Just one birdie on the back, and that was what's missing. He couldn't do it on 18 multiple times now. So I think kind of Cantlay actually blew that one. The story, though, a couple other stories from this tournament I want to mention, Mike. The young guy, Thigala, he was a sponsor's exemption. Saturday, he was lights out. For some reason, he was on TV a ton. Obviously, he was going up the leaderboard, ended up leading at the end of the day. But his irons were great. He had that lead, but he just seemed to lose his swing on the back nine on Sunday. Balls were kind of hooking to the left, got himself into trouble. Felt bad for him. He was very emotional. They caught it on camera with him and his parents. You know, it's a big deal to win because you get that tour card for another 2 or 3 years. You get into all the big tournaments. You get into the majors, the WGCs, which just gives you more opportunities at winning and winning big. And this guy's playing great. He got into the exemption. I just hope he gets another chance to get back to the spot.
Yeah, he's won at Pepperdine, really good collegiate player. And, you know, I'm sure as 24-year-old rookie here, we'll see his name more and more. He's playing this week at the Genesis. So, you know, the more he plays, the more opportunities he's going to have to put his name on the board and, you know, get back in the conversation here. But a good story. Nice to see, you know, you have some of your vets, your recognizable names. Brooks Koepka right up there finishes tied for third. Some of the other guys, Schauffele, JT, Matsuyama, all kind of in and around the top 10. And, you know, a good story like Thigala. So that's what makes the PGA great.
Which is what's making this tournament a must-attend event for some of these big-name players. Hats off to the crew that put this on. It's what a great event. They've made it must-attend for golf fans, and they let the people have some fun and draw attention to it. More of the big players are now coming. They want to be involved. They all watch football. They watch baseball, basketball, hockey. They want that feeling of walking into the stadium and having the hair on the back of your neck stand up and then being able to have a magical moment that might happen. I think that's what is drawing players to this tournament. Now, a couple things I thought about while watching this tournament, Mike. First is, I think that this golf course needs to host a Ryder Cup. Could you imagine what a spectacle having all those American fans on 16 chanting and cheering on all the players? And then obviously when the Americans go up to hit, to have that, I think it's like 20,000 to 30,000 people just around the 16th hole, to have them all go dead silent as the American golfer hits on that 16. And if he hits it close, that place would erupt. I think that would be a must event to attend, and they think they should do it. The other thing is, I think that one of the playoff holes, they should have gone back to 16. Yeah. They did 18 three times. I get it. You want the ending to be on the 18th green, but after twice, let's change it up. Get everyone back to 16 and let's have it there. Then move to 17, 18 if you got to keep going. I think that was a big miss. And the last thing I got to mention, Mike, Saturday, unbelievable. Sam Ryder, hole in one. Unbelievable to see. I mean, my wife was watching with me. She was even like, what is going on? This place is crazy. They were spraying beers and throwing it all over the place. They were all into it. I could not imagine being there. What a feeling that would have been. The energy. I felt bad for Brian Harman. He had to wait about 20 minutes before he could tee off and hit his shot. But I think it was well worth the wait. anyone that was there, players, staff, fans, they'll never forget that moment. I felt bad for the guy who hit the one the next day because it was kind of the first one was the big one, but what a sight to see.
Yeah, for sure. Good theater, as they say. And I mean, yeah, that'd be interesting if they did put a Ryder Cup there and how that would go. Distinct advantage, I think, for the home side. But it's good. It's one of those things, like we said, it's definitely become like the party spot on tour, and it makes that tournament unique and attractive for a lot of players, which sometimes it's tough to do as you get into the thick of things here in February ahead of the first major.
Our first two topics took up a lot of air in the sports world this week, but there are some other international events taking place, and the Olympics will be our T3. Into the second week of the Beijing 2022 Winter Olympics, and the media attention seems low and the excitement level even lower. The women's hockey is wrapping up with Canada versus the USA, while the men are just getting underway. Skiing, skating, snowboarding have had some interesting moments, but Mike, I'm assuming you want to start with a breakdown of the curling.
Sure. I think I'll echo kind of what I said last week. It's just, I think with the time difference, that's, for me, that's the biggest issue. It's you look at a couple events you want to watch or a couple athletes you want to see perform. It's like, oh, it's at 11 p.m. or 3 a.m. or however it breaks down. I'm just finding it difficult to find any consistency with the scheduling because of the time difference. Curling doubles ended. The mixed doubles, as we mentioned, Italy finished undefeated, won the whole thing. On the men's side right now, Brad Gushue 4-2 in round robin as of Monday. And Jennifer Jones was 1-3, won her last two games. So she's put herself and her team back in the thick of things. They pretty much go out through the week. And I believe the men's finals run Saturday, the women's championship on Sunday. So both teams hanging in there and trying to get into the top four. So good responses after some tough losses, and they're right in the thick of things.
Yeah, and for me, I mean, the main event I've been following is the women's hockey. Mm-hmm. I mentioned it coming in. It's the, without the NHLers there, it's the prized event of this Olympics. We know it's going to be Canada-USA, which it is going to be. There's been some interesting takes about how these two countries' dominance is actually bad for women's hockey, and I totally disagree. Such a bad take by some actually very intelligent people who have said it, so really disappointed about that. I think it's something that we look forward to every 4 years, knowing that these two are going to play against each other. They're winning at massive margins against the other countries. The other countries just can't keep up. But they'll eventually get better over time, and it'll allow for those countries to one day have their kind of miracle on ice moment when they face Canada or USA, and we just don't know when or who it will be, but it's going to happen eventually. So while we have the time to enjoy Canada versus USA before those other countries get there, enjoy it. It's the biggest rivalry in women's sports, all of women's sports. And it happens every 4 years. We know it's going to happen. It's always a great game. It's always close. Either one can win. And the only disappointing thing, I actually wish it was a best 2 out of 3. So we could see these two teams play against each other 3 times possibly with so much on the line, because one game is just not enough at how skilled these women are.
Yeah. And that's the other thing with the time. 11 o'clock Wednesday night is the game. As I get a little older, it gets harder and harder to keep awake. But this Canadian women team, they're setting some records along the way. Brianne Jenner tied an Olympic record with 9 goals. Claire Thompson, defender, 2 goals, 10 assists in 6 games, set the record for most points by a defenseman. Sarah Nurse, Wisconsin Badger, 4 assists against Switzerland in the semifinal. So there's a lot of good stories here. Really strong team, and USA beat Finland 4-1 the other game. So I was looking back, just to your point, and the only time these two countries didn't meet in the finals, do you remember when it was?
I want to say it was 8 years ago, and I want to say Finland beat USA to get into it.
I have to do the math, but it was 2006.
Okay,
so way more than 8, and it was Sweden. Sweden was in the final against Canada. So, but every other year, you know, the U.S. won in 98. In 2018, they are the defending champions. And Canada, of course, 02, 06, 2010, and 2014.
Yeah, and just like every year, we're going to get Canada, U.S. in the women's final. Every year, we're going to get a Russian doping scandal. And it happened again. The Russian figure skater, Kamila Velevev, she tested positive for a banned substance prior to the Olympics. But now all her tests since she's got to Beijing have been clean since she arrived. So they're going to actually allow her to skate. It was just voted that she's good to participate. I mean, she's the favorite. And she's only 15 years old. The substance, I guess, was for her heart. Now, listen, she's only 15. I can't blame her at all here. Clearly, she's taking the medication because she's being told to take the medication by coaches, the federation, whoever. And it's just wrong. And that's the part that really bugs me about the Olympics. I'm just so sick of all the drug scandals. And it happens every single year. It brings the whole games down. It takes attention away from the athletes actually participating. And I feel so bad for someone that gets a silver and then 2 months later, it comes out that the gold medal winner was taking something. And now it's like, oh, by the way, you're the winner. We'll send you your gold in the mail. I mean, that sucks. I mean, yeah, you go around saying, oh, I'm a gold medal winner, but you got no video of it. I mean, if you test positive, out, done, gone. See you later. I mean, there's got to be a way to be rapidly testing these athletes nonstop right up to the start of the event. You got to watch the documentary on the Olympics in Sochi and the stunts that they were pulling there. It's wild what people will do to cheat in sports and to win. It's just sad that it's happening all again, and it's happening to a 15-year-old girl. I feel terrible for her too. Other big events that I kind of got into, Mike, was the snowboarding big air. Essentially, it's you get on the snowboard, go flying down a hill, go about 30 feet in the air, try to do some massive trick, kind of like you used to do on your PlayStation when you played those snowboarding games, and then you try to land it. Funny thing is, though, once you get up in the air about 30 feet, all you see is the nuclear power plants all around the big air event. It's ridiculous. How they picked this place to be hosting the Olympics when they got the big air jammed between the power plants. It looks so stupid.
I haven't partaked in any of the viewing, but I will take your word for it.
And then the other one that's actually become a favorite of my kids is the luge and bobsled. So here's what the luge and bobsled should actually do. If I was on the Canadian luge and bobsled committee, here's what I would do. I'd go around to every high school in the country and I'd go talk to the principal and I would say, who's the craziest kid you got in the school? And when they say, yeah, it's Johnny over there or it's Lisa over there, I would say, all right, you guys come with me. I'd round up all the craziest kids in the country. And I'd say, guess what? I'm going to put you on this little sled and push you down this hill and go, because you've got to be nuts to be in any of these events. You're just asking to wipe out and scrape. You're wearing just little latex as you fly down there. If you fall, I mean, I fall on the ice in my backyard. I'm out two to three days. These guys just skid all the way down. And then the worst one, I'd go back to the principals and I would say, hey, who's the craziest kid that you had to expel from your school? Oh, and they say, oh, that's Timmy. That's Timmy. Well, I go get Timmy. I bring him. And you know what I do with him? I put him on the skeleton team. Because skeleton, you're going face first right down this thing going 124 kilometers per hour. You have got to be out of your mind to do some of these events. I don't know how these people get into them, but they're definitely the craziest people in the country.
Daredevils, extreme sports.
Daredevils.
Not my cup of tea.
Yeah, not me either. Yeah.
I have enough trouble walking the dog when the sidewalks are icy in the winter. That's my extreme sport.
That's your Olympic sport.
Yeah.
Dog walking.
Not falling. Yeah.
Now, it's funny to think what life would be like for Dave Tippett and Dominic Ducharme if the NHLers actually went to the Olympics. And that will be our T4. This week, two NHL coaches from Canadian teams got the axe as Dominic Ducharme was fired in Montreal after the team lost 7 in a row and sit in last place in the NHL. The next night, after the Edmonton Oilers lost 4-1 to the Blackhawks, it was Dave Tippett's turn to get the pink slip. Mike, we never want to see coaches lose their jobs, but which of these made more sense?
7 changes now this season, I believe we're at.
That's hockey.
I was reading an article. I can't remember where it was, but basically the gist of it was, you know, very rarely do hockey coaches get long-term deals, right? Like it just doesn't happen because the turnover is so high. it feels like neither one is surprising. I think Montreal, unfortunately, has been battling injuries majority of the year. But, I mean, 8 wins out of almost 40 games, 40-plus games is, you know, you're not usually going to survive that. And with Edmonton, bit of a different circumstance. You know, they got off to a hot start, cooled down in December, and, you know, since then just really haven't gotten out of that. 7-13-3 was their current record before the change, before Woodcroft was put in. But, you know, I don't think either one was overly surprising. I think people were calling for Tippett a lot earlier, but they wanted to see how things went. But neither is truly shocking, I don't think, to me anyway.
Yeah, it's funny enough, in my friends group chat, we're talking about hockey all the time. And I said, if the Oilers lose this game, I think Tippett's going to get axed. And sure enough, they lost 4-1 to the Blackhawks, which was a bad loss. But I think the Oilers one makes more sense. They're only 4 points out of the last wildcard spot. You got the 2 best players, arguably, in the league. They could get hot at any time. Let's look at Montreal last year, right? Just get in the playoffs, you never know. And that needs to be the Oilers' mindset. Tippett was a defense-first coach who was brought in to help build a structure with these offensive powerhouse players, and he was never able to really do it. It just did not work. 147 goals against is the 4th worst in the Western Conference, and their goal differential is -1. -1 when you have all that offense and all those guys scoring, 2 guys in the top 5 in league scoring. There was frustration amongst the players and obviously the media too, with multiple altercations between them. I think it was just time for a change. Jay Woodcroft, he's well respected. He's a minor league coach who's done very well. He'll let these players play. He'll help try to find a solution. He's already cut back both McDavid and Draisaitl's minutes to keep them fresh for the final 5. And it worked in their first game together, winning over the Islanders 3-1 the other night. But really, the Oilers, their problem's goaltending. And with the cap crunch that they're in, I don't know if they'll be able to address it at the trade deadline. They're kind of stuck with what they got, and what they got is not good. So the Oilers, I just don't think it's going to be in the cards this year, but it was the right time to make the change in hopes that they're able to get hot, get a little coach bump, and get into the playoffs.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, for him, for Woodcroft, if they finish the season well, maybe he makes a compelling argument to keep the job full time. If they get in, obviously that happens. But even if they perform better, he probably, you know, sets himself up to remove the interim tag.
Which is exactly what happened in Montreal, right? Last year, they fire Claude Julien. They bring in Dominic Ducharme, interim guy. They get hot. They go all the way to the Stanley Cup. They sign him to this deal. And then you start this year. But man, what a dumpster fire in Montreal, which is amazing because 8 months ago, look where they were. Stanley Cup finals with an actual legitimate chance to win with the best goalie in the world. But that's the big difference. The big difference between Montreal last year and this year, and even Montreal and Edmonton, is Carey Price. They don't have Carey Price this year. They had him last year. They were able to be one of the top teams because he's the best goalie in the world. And without him playing, I just don't think they have a real chance. And Ducharme, he was only supposed to really be the interim, and now he's out, and who knows if he'll ever get another chance at coach. Now, bringing in Martin St. Louis, I mean, he's a Hall of Fame player. He's a competitor. He always wants to win at every level, NHL, Olympics, Worlds. Apparently, he's a hell of a peewee hockey coach in Connecticut. I don't know how he's going to do in the NHL. He's got his work cut out for him. He's still not going to get Carey Price. He's not going to have Shea Weber coming back. He's got some tough players. They just traded Tyler Toffoli today to Calgary, so that's another piece out the door that he won't be able to work with. But you know what? The players are going to respect him. They're going to listen to him. And if he loves it and he's passionate about it, he could be good at it. But this team, they won't be good for another 4 or 5 years, and that's if they draft good. If they draft some good players, get lucky with those balls bouncing around that they get one of the top picks one of those years. Other than that, I really don't think they're going to be that good, and I don't know if he has the patience for it. I mean, if I'm a retired NHL player who's made $56 million in career earnings, I will be on a beach or a golf course somewhere. No thanks to the grind of the NHL, coaching, watching film, having to deal with spoiled pros and deal with all the nonsense with the media, especially in Montreal. I don't know why St. Louis wants to get involved, but if he wants to do it, let them take a chance at it.
Stark, the only other thing I wanted to touch on before we shift gears here, there's been a lot of chatter recently about another World Cup of hockey potentially happening in a couple of years. What are your thoughts on that?
I love the idea. I think having a World Cup of Hockey in February is the right move. In the past, they've done it kind of that late August, early September, almost
pre-season,
like a preseason. The guys aren't fully ready to go. They're not in the grind of the hockey season yet, or that mindset. Not to mention they brought in the, you know, the under 22 North American team and the European team, and it just made it funky. So I think that they should do it properly. And I think this is the route to do it. I mean, they stopped the season for the Olympics, and truthfully, they can make this better without the restrictions that the Olympics kind of put on you. You can play it in groups of, you know, 8 teams, 10 teams, whatever you think the right number is. You have half of them play in North America in Group A. You have the other half playing in Europe in Group B. You build it up every 4 years, make it mean something. Make it mean something to be on your national team, something that is kind of a yearly thing where you always know who's on the Canadian national team for your hockey, and you make the adjustments as you go. Similar to the way soccer does it, if you really think about it. You have your camp maybe every summer. You keep the players working out together, always connected. You have a select coach that's not an NHL coach, and his job's just to be the national team coach. I think that's a great idea. It works in soccer, and I think that's what they need to do. It's expected that around the world, every soccer league knows when to shut down for international play, so these players can go back and play for their home countries, and everyone's doing it. And that's the way it works, and that's how they make it work. Obviously, hockey does not have as many teams that they could pull for a World Cup, but if you do this right, you can build it up to the point that, hey, maybe in 10 years, there's 16 good teams. And then in 30 years, maybe there's 25 countries that have a legitimate chance at playing in a World Cup. But it needs to start now, and it needs to start doing it the right way. And I think mid-season, NHL season, February, you get all the NHL players, all the pros playing in KHL or all the different leagues, get them into it, and let's do it right over a 2.5-week period in the middle of the season every 4 years.
Yeah, it's a good idea. I mean, that, you know, it definitely kind of follows the soccer model, and club teams respect the FIFA windows, as they call them, the FIFA calendar. So something like that, I think, you know, could be interesting. I like the point about the, you know, a national team coach, where a guy, you know, is just coaching the national team and will, you know, run some camps and everything like that. And it doesn't take away from their NHL preparation. So interesting concept. It be interesting to see if it does take off and what it can evolve into. And the preseason thing, it definitely feels like they're not in full gear yet, obviously, for obvious reasons.
Not just the players, the fans too. Fans aren't really into it in late August watching competitive hockey. So now, staying in North America for our T5, and this week, lost in the shuffle, was the NBA trade deadline, which is sneaky one of the biggest sports days of the year, and we will break it down in our T5. Mayhem and chaos was the theme of the NBA trade deadline, which saw MVPs, all-stars, number one picks, and future draft picks all be traded in one day. The entire landscape of the NBA has shifted, and the chase for the playoffs is underway. Mike, who is the big winner this week?
I think it's hard not to say the Philadelphia 76ers were.
I agree.
I mean, they go from a pretty good team to a pretty damn good team with the addition of James Harden to what they have there already, and really puts them into the thick of things in the Eastern Conference. I mean, the East right now is pretty much run by Miami. You know, the Bulls are up there, defending champions, the Bucks, Boston, I think a top defensive team in the league. So the East is really going to be interesting to see how it shakes out in the second half here and into the playoff race.
Yeah, the Harden-Simmons trade was one of those things that the rumors have been kind of out there for a couple of weeks in advance. And I think it really was a win-win for both the teams, the 76ers and the Nets. And they both happened to be the biggest winners of the day, and they made the trade together. I mean, Simmons wasn't even playing for the 76ers. He wasn't part of the team. The Sixers get an MVP-type player in James Harden that can control the backcourt and allow Embiid to dominate the paint. It's a perfect mix, and I'm seriously considering a future on Philadelphia. Note that one. The Nets, they kind of hated Harden by this point. They wanted him gone. They've already got two guys that love to handle the ball. There's no need for a third. KD and Kyrie, they can score at will on their own, and they'll put Ben Simmons in place to be successful. He'll be able to rebound, play really good defense, and he'll be a nice little addition to this team when they already got the two superstar offensive guys that are going to handle it. But you mentioned the East. For me, the big loser was the Lakers. They really did nothing. I mean, the Lakers have to be the biggest loser of the day. Westbrook, he's being benched every single game. He's clearly not being invited to the cool table with LeBron. They've had their issues. They look old and lost. Actually, they've given up in multiple games. Even LeBron said they can't beat the top teams like the Bucks. The Lakers didn't add anyone, which shows they're riding out the year, and then they're going to rebuild. The question is, though, is LeBron going to really want to be part of any sort of rebuild at his age? I don't really think so. They're a hot mess.
Yeah, it's really in the East to see how this plays out. I think Philly has made a major move here, and you're going to see the standing shift, obviously. But for Brooklyn, too, I mean, their trade, they gave up a ton to get James Harden. Now they receive a ton in return, so it allows them to restock the cupboard and go again as well.
Yeah, it'll be interesting how that trade with those two teams in the East getting better, how it's going to affect the Toronto Raptors. I really like Masai. I do. I think he makes all the right moves, and until he doesn't make a good move, I trust each one he makes. So going out there and getting a player like Thaddeus Young might be the right thing to do, because his team is just gelling so well right now. They're playing great. They're on a great winning streak. You might as well let it keep running until it falls apart. So no point making a big deal that's going to change one of your main pieces. Add to it. Build it. He kind of got handcuffed in that Lowry sign-in trade where he got stuck with Goran Dragic, who for some reason doesn't want to play in Toronto, whatever it was. So making this move and getting rid of a piece that really you're not losing anything that from your roster might have been the right thing to do. But the smart thing he did, the thing I really, really liked, was he traded draft picks, but he protected the hell out of them. So it's a protected 1 through 14 in 2022, which I don't think it'll be, but there's a chance they could fall apart and it could fall in there. So don't want to give away that piece. You move to 2023. It's now protected 1 to 13. Who knows how that's going to turn out? So make sure you don't lose another top pick. And if those don't happen, the pick then goes to 2 second round picks. I mean, what smart managing to not lose a high draft pick. I hope Berkey's listening after his whole Kessel Sagan debacle with his draft picks not being protected. So Masai's making all the right moves. I think this is going to be a team that's going to play in the playoffs, the Raptors, have some success, hopefully. They're a gritty team. I can't wait to watch them down the stretch here.
Yeah, 8-10 in their, or 8-2, sorry, in their past 10 games, and above 500 right in a playoff spot. They're a very solid team. The East gets a little tougher, obviously, with the shift with Philly getting into things now. But Raptors are a solid team.
Now, after the success of our season-long NFL picks, we are going to try something a little different, but that will put Mazzaro versus Stark in a season-long battle of golf picks. Each week, we will draft 3 golfers playing in the PGA Tour event that week. If one of our players wins the tournament, we'll be awarded 10 points. If they finish in the top 5, you will get 5 points. And if they're in the top 10, you will get 2 points. Mike, you understand the rules?
Yep.
Perfect. This week, the PGA is at Riviera for Tiger's tournament, the Genesis Open. Last year's winner was Max Homa. So, Mike, I'm such a nice guy. I'll let you have the first pick.
Thank you. I'm picking with my first overall pick a guy who's played well at the Riviera, Dustin Johnson.
Very good pick. I saw he was at the Super Bowl having a good time, so hopefully he's in good shape and makes it there. I'm going to go with the number one player in the world. He was in the top 5 last year, and he's definitely going to make some noise here. I'll go with John Rahm.
Okay. With my second pick, I'm going to go with one of the hottest golfers on tour right now. I think it's 6 consecutive top 10s for Mr. Patrick Cantlay.
Very good. Should have won that yesterday. Could have won me some money, but no. he didn't.
Might win this week.
That. I'm going to go with someone who always is looked at to be winning these tournaments. He's due to really run off a whole bunch. I think his game is perfect for this event, and it's going to lead him into a really good time at the majors this year. Justin Thomas.
The way you were talking, I thought you were going to pick the guy that I was about to take, but it wasn't Justin Thomas. So for me, my third pick, if they were available, was really between two guys. Since he's still on the board, I'm going to take him. I'm going to take Brooks Koepka. I think he's looked pretty good last week. And, you know, he has, what, 8 wins on tour, 4 of the majors. And these big events here, like the Genesis, tougher course, his name's usually in the conversation. So I'm going with Brooks to have 2 good back-to-back weeks here.
Nice. Well, I'm going to go with one of the hottest golfers in the world. And when I say world, it's because he's been playing all over the place and doing well. I'll go Victor Hovland.
Ooh, I thought you were going to say Colin.
Colin hasn't played much. Hasn't played too much.
No, he's only played a couple tournaments. The other guy I was considering, Bubba.
Bubba?
Won a couple times here at the Genesis. Hasn't missed the cut the past couple years. So, I think Brooksy's a safer bet.
Yeah, I think Bubba's done, unfortunately. He'll just keep playing the Masters till he's wraps it up. But that wraps up our golf picks and our T5. We'll be putting on our manager's hats coming up right after the break, so stick around. It's time to make some decisions. This weekend, we were trying to decide between nachos, chicken wings, maybe some fine cheese. But today, we are going to decide who is playing and who is a bum in Stardom Benchem. But clearly, Mike and I were in different moods. Maybe it's because I was at a kid's birthday party while Mike was sipping on cocktails, marinating steaks. Mike has decided he wants to start 2 guys, while I'll be benching 2 guys. Guess you're a player's coach, and I'm John Tortorella, Mike. So, Mike, start us off with the 2 guys you'll be starting this week.
The first is the NFL honors as a whole. Thursday night, the NFL did their yearly awards evening, and I agreed with pretty much everyone who won the individual awards. Some of the main ones, obviously, Defensive Player of the Year, TJ Watt, Defensive Rookie of the Year, Micah Parsons, Offensive Rookie of the Year, Ja'Marr Chase, Offensive Player of the Year, Cooper Kupp, Comeback Player, Joe Burrow, Walter Payton Man of the Year, Andrew Whitworth, and MVP, Aaron Rodgers. I think, quite honestly, of those major awards of the 7 I mentioned there, you really couldn't look at those and say, you know what, somebody else deserved it. I think the winners were truly deserving. The show was 2 hours long. It was nice, tight, good mix of comedy, you know, interaction with some of the players. Roger Goodell sang for a little bit. So it was really good. The thing I also enjoy is that they reveal the upcoming induction class for the Hall of Fame. And when they show some of those videos, one in particular I really enjoyed was when Leroy Butler of the Green Bay Packers was informed at his house by Charles Woodson that he was getting in. It was a really good video, and Leroy comes out of his house not even wearing shoes, and he's like, this better not be a lie. And, you know, just seeing the emotion that a lot of these guys have, because it's obviously a massive, massive honor. So I just enjoy the awards part of it, the reveal videos for the Hall of Fame. And, you know, it was just a very tight show, 2 hours. Here's the winners. The winners were deserving. And it was kind of a nice little tee up event a couple days before, you know, the Super Bowl. I think they've done it the night before in the past. I like this, give it a little more separation of a couple days, and, you know, was really well done. The other thing I'm starting, continuing with this theme, was the Coach of the Year, Mike Vrabel. Now, at first, I thought my boy Matt LaFleur was a shoo-in.
So did I.
Given the 13-3 record and everything. But when you think of it, you know, Mike Vrabel leads the Titans, 12-5 record. They started off 6-2. Derrick Henry, who is the top running back in football, in the MVP conversation, was having a great start to the season. He goes down in week eight, done pretty much for the rest of the season. He eventually came back in the playoffs, but to navigate through losing your best player and not only make the playoffs, but win your division and the number one seed, regardless of what happens in the playoffs. I mean, that's a separate thing in and of itself, but to navigate those tough waters like the Titans had to, and you know, win the division and be the first overall seed going into the playoffs while not having your best player for majority of the season, it was impressive. And I think, you know, when you look at it that way, Mike Vrabel was certainly deserving. As much as I would have liked to have seen Matt LaFleur get it, it's hard to knock Vrabel winning Coach of the Year. So very NFL awards theme, but that is who I have started for this week. And Stark, I'm going to turn over to you to be the bearer of bad news. Who's getting benched?
Geez, I'm the bad guy coming through here, coming into the dressing room.
Good players cop, bad cop.
Players are looking like, oh no, here he comes. He's coming to cut me. Well, I'm benching Vernon Hargraves. Who is that? He is the Cincinnati Bengals cornerback, or should I say former cornerback, who ran on the field to celebrate Jesse Bates' interception. Only problem, Hargraves was inactive and in a hoodie and flip-flops, costing the Bengals 10 yards for taunting. They were down 13-10 with less than 2 minutes to go in the half, but with the penalty, they were forced to be conservative and run the clock out before the half. Great move, Hargraves. The NFL has too many people on the sidelines that should not be there. It's ridiculous and dangerous. If you don't have a uniform on or a headset, you should not be on the field. That goes for all the VIPs hanging out and media as well. Players get hit hard into the out-of-bounds area, and serious injuries could happen. Plus, with more people on the sidelines, it can cause confusion for the players, coaches, and even the refs. Not to mention, if Vernon was in the locker room watching on TV, maybe the Bengals tie it up before the half. Have a seat, Vernon. You might never play another NFL down.
Those sidelines, it happens at least once a week. A camera operator, a sound operator, a coach just gets plowed on the sidelines, and you feel it. You feel it.
There goes their ACL. Yeah.
Oh, God.
My favorite is when the security guard who's looking at the stands doing his job doesn't see it coming, and they just plow him from behind. Always feel bad for those guys. Now, my second benching. I'm benching the NHL. But why, do you ask? I'll tell you. Gary Bettman does his media press conference at the All-Star Game in Las Vegas with all the sponsors in attendance, including multiple gambling sites, while he's staying at a big casino. The NHL has embraced gambling and Vegas and is telling everyone who will listen they were the first ones on this ship in Vegas, and they want sports gambling to be part of the game. One problem, they're brutal at it, and the old boys club still runs the league. If you are serious about having casual hockey fans bet on your sport to drive viewership, Gary needs to make it mandatory that coaches name a starting goalie and disclose injuries 4 hours prior to puck drop. Yes, 4 hours. That's not too bad. I am sick of refreshing websites to find out if Vasilevskiy's in net for the Lightning or if it's Brian Elliott. It's a big difference and could determine if I bet on the game and therefore watch it. Who are you fooling by not telling anyone till the anthem starts and one goalie standing in the starter's net? Same goes for injuries. If you're going to have a player play, release your starting roster so people have time to set their fantasy lineups. Yes, it seems stupid if you're not into gambling or don't play fantasy sports, but look at the NFL. It's driving their business and making casual fans diehard fans. So Gary and your team of dinosaurs, have a seat on the bench till you figure this one out.
Strong words.
You love that, Mr. one, Starkin.
The fantasy aspect, I agree. I mean, the NFL does a really good job with the injury reports. Great and job. You know, there's always some speculation as to if guys are going to be in or out that are questionable come Sunday morning. But that's what Jay Glazer and the insiders and all those guys are good at in the morning shows, keeping us informed. But Yeah, it's funny when you preface it because of betting and fantasy, but it's true. It you know, it definitely makes a difference.
Now, each week, Mike and I will give you our best bet of the week to help you make some cash. And boy, did we do good this weekend at the Super Bowl. My over 5.5 sacks hit early in the third quarter at +105, and Mike's Higgins most receiving yards hit at +600. Way to go, Mike. After that prop winner, I'll let you have the tea with your pick this week.
I had to make up for the Baylor pick a couple weeks earlier. So I'm going to ride my luck and go back to the collegiate game. Saturday afternoon, we got a Big Ten matchup. It's going to be big, keeping with the theme of the conference. The 12th-ranked Illinois Fighting Illini go to Michigan State, 19th-ranked Spartans. The last time they played in January, Illinois won 56-55. This could be big for the Big Ten championship and the tournament and everything. I'm saying the Spartans win at home on the money line.
Wow. Nice. Might want to look at the under two if they're playing a full game to 55-56 or whatever it was.
Yeah, jeez. 1 point, yeah.
That's Big Ten basketball for you. All right, I'm going to the Genesis because with no football this weekend, I'll be all over the golf. Last year, John Rahm finished tied for fifth at this tournament, and 2 years prior in 2019, he was tied for ninth. Not to mention last week at the WM, he was a T10. All this made my eyes pop out when I saw that John Rahm to finish top 10 this week was +115, plus money for the top 10. I'll take it. John Rahm, top 10 at the Genesis this weekend. Now, we want to hear from you, so make sure to comment on the pod wherever you download your podcast and let us know your thoughts on Twitter and Instagram. We love the feedback. Check us out on Instagram and Twitter at JABOPod, thestringer.ca, and find Mike and I on Twitter to see our thoughts on all the sports throughout the week. Please subscribe, like, and rate our show, and do us a favor and tell a friend to listen. And as always, clear eyes,
full hearts,
can't lose.
Oh, yeah.